Hi, everybody. Welcome to the 99th episode of Media Voices. Only one more, and then we get a telegram from the podcast queen. I can't quite believe we've got this far. How about you, Esther?
Yeah, I also can't quite believe we've got this far. Who's the podcast queen?
I think it's Sarah Koenig.
Oh, that'd be nice getting a telegram.
So, I'm your host, Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
I'm Peter Hurston.
So, 99th episode today, we are going to be celebrating our 100th episode on Thursday, May the 2nd. So, in London, we're going to be doing a live panel looking at the topic, how do publishers maintain their brand value in a world of distributed content? And Esther, that's too big a topic for us to do on our own. So, how many other people are going to be there talking about it with us?
We've got some experts in. We're going to be welcoming Biblio's Mads Holman, and Biblio are helping us organise the event. We've also got The Week's Kerin O'Connor, Pink News' Ellen Stewart, she's head of platforms there. And we've also got the legendary Terry White, who is Empire's editor-in-chief. So I'm pretty excited for that lineup.
I want to go to this. I want to see that.
Yeah.
So if you want to be at that event, the link to RSVP is on our website, social channels, and in our newsletter.
Fantastic. But before then, Peter, who did you talk to this week?
This week, I spoke to Rob Orchard. He's the co-founder and editorial director of the Slow Journalism Company, who famously published that darling of the indie magazine scene, home to some of the world's maddest infographics, Delayed Gratification.
But before that, and before our 100th episode, the news roundup, as ever. And so Facebook has proposed a new thing where it might feature content from publishers on a dedicated high-quality content tab, and also it might pay them. So what year are we in now?
You know, I can't even talk about this.
Coincidental timing with the Apple News Plus announcement, though.
Is it coincidental timing, or do you think this is, I don't know, them...
Coincidence? Yeah. I think not.
I mean, he's also not actually proposed anything yet. What he's done is, kind of in an interview, he's floated the idea that they might look at doing it... And there's a lot of mights in this. They might create a dedicated tab for news, and he's hinted that they may pay publishers to feature in it. And the publishing industry has gone bonkers.
You know, you could actually have a Facebook podcast. You could have a podcast just about the dipshit moves Facebook makes. And you could do it daily, never mind weekly.
I mean, Casey Newton literally has a daily newsletter dedicated to this.
Think about this week. What's come out this week? He wrote an op-ed for the Washington Post telling the world how to regulate social media. In The Guardian, one of his early investors, Roger McNamee, called the op-ed a monument to insincerity and misdirection.
Oh, that's such a fantastic phrase.
Great quote.
Actually, yeah.
The thing that depressed me most about this, I don't know if this... Business insiders are normally quite good at this thing, but they had this quote in this article that said, some insiders have warned that depending on Facebook for revenue will cost publishers their independence.
Gosh.
I mean, what, is this 2009?
Well, exactly, yeah.
But you know what? It's all going to be okay because they're running a bunch of articles in The Telegraph. And as we all know, every media executive on the planet reads The Telegraph. So it'll be fine.
So yeah, I've got an interesting question for you guys about this. Loads of people were calling out the Daily Telegraph online for allowing these to run. They were like, oh, you know, you've got no ethical sense. Like, why would you partner with Facebook for this? if it's...
Sorry, the...
Peter Corey, actually, sorry. It's just yeah, it got me.
The irony of that was just... I couldn't let it...
Yeah.
I don't know, if Facebook are partnering with you for sponsored content, why would you turn that down?
Because your front page said Facebook's a bunch of bastards and they're ruining the planet.
In which case, take their money while you can.
No, the hypocrisy in the British press is just...
Yeah, you surprised
endemic.
Me. And I kind of respect that hypocrisy because it's so blatant.
We've reached a new point on Media Voice. We now have to find people's deep, deep hypocrisy to find any respect.
Just think, guys, by the time we come back to recording our 100th episode, we might be out of the EU.
Oh, God.
God.
We also might not.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Fingers fucking crossed. All right.
Oh, sweepstake.
Hey, and speaking of people who are pro-EU, The Guardian has set a target to attract 2 million paying supporters over the next 3 years. Do any of us really doubt that they can do that at the moment, considering what's happening with, you know, NYT subscriber numbers. And
it depends how much bigger they make those footer boxes.
So where are they at now? They've got like a million?
They hit the million mark last year, because that was just 3 years after launching the membership model in the first place. So I think the idea is that they said, right, if we can get to a million in 3 years, we can get to 2 million in 6 years. But then they want to hit 2 million paying supporters ahead of their 200th anniversary in the year 2022.
Yeah.
It's a lot of twos.
It is. And, you know, for what it's worth, two million is not that big a number.
Well, okay, but here's where I get to play devil's avocado.
Oh, shit.
Ooh.
Because that first million, or even the first million and a half, is low-hanging fruit, right? So
yeah.
The rest is harder.
It also
involves some serious retention efforts.
And they are going up against more and more and more people putting up paywalls.
Yeah.
So I think you're right. It doesn't seem impossible, doesn't seem mental, but I don't think it'll be that easy.
They're looking to do it through expansion into other geographies rather than...
Oh my God, didn't The Guardian try that before and it just totally fucked up?
No, apparently they've got the US, which is doing really... that's self-supporting now.
Yeah, but because they cut back a ton, it's not.
Yeah.
If you look at the territories which have huge potential for subscriptions, there are already some significant players out there. So if you look at Brazil and the rest of like South America, they have a bunch of subscription players there already. So they're relying on the English language news network, and that's where we have like Chris Duncan coming in saying there can only be 10. English language
I didn't
news.
Say there can only be one.
He didn't say he wasn't referencing Highlander.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think you'll get to the point where if more publications put up paywalls and you've got, you pay for two or three, are you going to continue donating to The Guardian given you can still get the content for free? Mm.
This is a good story. I don't want to talk about Australian laws or Facebook anymore. I want to talk about stories like this because this is interesting.
But just to put that into context, the NYT has set itself the goal of having 10 million subscriptions by 2025.
Yeah, America's a bit bigger, though. Come on.
Yeah, I know, but The Guardian is an international English language paper. Mm. So they're direct competitors in that sense.
Yeah, but The Guardian also has a position that the New York Times doesn't have. The Guardian's a left-leaning paper. Okay, they support the liberals, and well, none of us will ever forgive them for that. But they have a political position that doesn't fly in the States particularly well.
Joe, the one that surprised me is that I'm surprised the FT have only just surpassed a million.
Well, I'm not surprised by that, actually, thinking about it, because it's, if you think about what people are actually paying for with that, it is kind of the high-end news and business information.
Yeah, the price point's quite high.
The other thing would be an interesting comparison, because if The Guardian says it's got a million paying supporters, is that regular supporters? Is that a million people that have given donations at some point?
Well, when they have broken out in the past, that's not recurring revenue for the most part.
But, I mean, it's obviously helping them towards their break-even goal, so...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yay!
From people who we thought might not be doing particularly well to people who are launching new products, the Stylist Group has launched a new fitness vertical, Stylist Strong, which will involve opening a studio in London. So it's looking to offer smart, class-based workouts for busy women who are interested in building their physical and mental strength. So this is basically them building on what they said they were going to do with the Stylist brand back when they shortlist, right? They were going to concentrate on this kind of high-value, primarily female audience.
Yeah, actually, what I love about this is when I first sort of saw the headline that they were launching a new fitness vertical, I just thought, oh, great, you know, it's going to be more, you know, women are fat, we need to get thin, how can we get thin? But actually, the whole way they've positioned this is that a lot of their readers want to focus on getting strong, and that's not just... that's not just strong physically, that's strong mentally as well. And Women's Health did a very similar thing with their Fit Nights Out. It's this focus on kind of wellness and the fact that actually, yeah, we are more than just our appearance. And so, yeah, this fitness vertical that they're launching is about being strong mentally and physically, which I just think is really smart.
No, I think, we talked a lot about this kind of brand extension idea and that idea that they're going into something that people have live events, they've got to go along to it, it's recurring revenue again. But it's good, it's really good, it's a clever thing. I got a bit confused though by the class-based workouts though, because I was like, what's that mean? You're like, you've got to be really posh. Oh, no air for the likes of you. That was a weird one.
No, not that.
Not what I know, Esther. It's a joke.
Just checking. I was just checking. I have a caveat for this though, and that is that there's been no release of any kind of price point or whether this is going to be.
Oh, so
pitched.
It could be class based.
It could. Well, this is the problem with a lot of fitness in London is that it's completely inaccessible to certain financial brackets. Mm. You know, gym memberships are extortionate. Even dip in and out classes are quite expensive. So, if they can make this accessible to kind of the women that actually read it, it could be great. If it's really expensive, then yeah, it's going to be a shoot and miss. So in brief, Time magazine has grown its staff by nearly 20% under new owner Mark Benioff. So yay for more jobs.
Yay, Mark Benioff. More than 200,000 cult members have subscribed to Apple News Plus in its first 48 hours. Whoop, 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 whoop. Esther's got a great number on this. What is it, Esther?
Well, I checked out and it's about 90 million people subscribe to Apple News. 90 million people use Apple News, which means that that's about 0.2% of its user base that have subscribed.
So we want to give a quick shout out to the MA publishing students from the London College of Communication at the University of the Arts in London. They're organising the 15th annual Publishing Innovation Conference on the 25th of April, focused on the interaction between readers and publishers. We'll put a link in the newsletter and out on social media, but come down, there's some great speakers, although I'll be there. And it'll be fun. They're a great bunch of people and it'll be great.
We have a growing transcript section on our website thanks to a clever AI transcription tool from Trint. So you can just go to voices.media/transcripts to see them all, where there's also a link to our dedicated email list that sends them out every Monday, and you should sign up.
And a little shout out to our Trintern, Nadia Zegmot, who's been tidying them all up for us.
Yay, Nadia!
Thank you so much. You're doing the Lord's work, Nadia.
This week I spoke to Rob Orchard. He's the editorial director of the original slow journalism magazine, Delayed Gratification. We spoke about the rise of slow journalism, the need for slow journalism, and what it means that companies like Tortoise are picking up on slow journalism. But first, I asked Rob to explain how he came to launch Delayed Gratification.
So Delayed Gratification is the slow journalism magazine. It was launched in January of 2011, with an idea of giving an antidote to knee-jerk, Twitter-driven digital news reporting. So we spotted that things were getting faster and faster and faster in terms of news reporting, and that was throwing up quite a lot of problems, and that it was also becoming a bit overwhelming. So this was a time when, you know, live blogging was just really starting to kind of come in. The number of journalists was being decreased. There was a heavy reduction in newsroom staff at the same time as the amount of space that the remaining journalists had to fill was increasing. So Delayed Gratification was a sort of a response to that. What it does as a magazine is once every 3 months, we draw a line in the sand, we return to the big stories of that quarter, and we ask that basic question: what happened next? So instead of trying to be first news stories, we proudly have this slogan that runs down the side of every magazine, which is last the breaking news. So the idea is we'll return to big stories, we'll ask the question of what happened after the dust settled and the rest of the media moved on. And very often that leads to us finding new elements of the stories, new aspects of the stories that weren't covered at the time.
You've just published number 33. What's the stories that you've covered? Just to give people an idea, what stories have you covered in issue 33?
There's some pretty serious stuff. So we have a very interesting insight into the murder of Jamal Khashoggi by a friend and former colleague of his. Some quite serious stuff around that. We've got a fascinating interview with the guy behind Bellingcat. So Bellingcat, that news organization that famously managed to unmask the identity of the Salisbury poisoners when British intelligence was unable to. So Elliot Higgins, fascinating interview with him, looking at how he and his network brought that about and what their aims are for the future. As a reaction to the petrifying announcements by the IPCC about climate change and how we've got 12 years left to avert complete global catastrophe, we have a really interesting story about geoengineering. So this idea that we might be able to, rather than just straightforwardly trying to kind of cut back our emissions, we might be able to have technological solutions.
So you've got Jamal Khashoggi on one side and you've got the environment on the other side. And they're two very important stories, but they're two very different stories. What ties them together for your audience?
Well, I think we really like to have a huge breadth of stories in the magazine. So we're not, it's not a politics magazine, but it has political stories. We have stories about society and culture, lots of stuff about sport. So I think what it is it's big events in that 3 month period that maybe kind of popped up on your radar and were probably covered quite intensely, you know, for 2 or 3 or 4 days, and then just kind of went away. So you may have had a little insight into the story, or you may have not been following it and just kind of been vaguely aware of it. We like to go back to the ones that seem to us to be important and really dig into them, go a bit deeper. So I suppose that's what unites it all together. I mean, ultimately, this is a magazine. So a magazine needs light and shade. It needs short articles. It needs funny stuff, as well as the big, deep, investigative stuff. It needs photo features. So part of it, you know, is just something that kind of that has a nice balance and is going to keep somebody captivated for 120 pages, hopefully. But the fundamental thing that links it all together is it happened in that quarter and we're going back to see what happened next.
So you go back to a story. I'm trying to get your production cycle clear in my head. You go back to a story that happened 3 months previous and then you've got a 3 month publication.
Not far off. So this latest issue covers October, November, December of 2018, and it's come out just now, so tail end of March. So obviously through that period, we're taking notes, we're looking at things, we are kind of writing ideas, we're starting doing some research and so on. But then as of the end of that period, end of December, we've effectively got 10 weeks to 12 weeks to turn everything around. And of course, there are long-running stories that we're working on kind of in the background that we do commission ahead and so on, because we know that there'll be certain hooks in the next period.
I've got issue one on myself. What have you learned since then?
Well, I distinctly remember getting issue one back from the printer, and we were in this absolutely tiny office on Tottenham Court Road. Tony Elliott of Time Out had very kindly given us some office space, and we were working away there. And it was funny. You could stretch out your hands and almost touch both walls. And we were working away there over the sort of the winter of 2010, putting this thing out, and obviously making everything up from scratch, not knowing what the design would be, and it was all kind of falling into place and so on. And when we got it back, I just thought, God, this is a perfect magazine. What a fantastic magazine! I've always worked in magazines. I was like, God, we nailed it. And looking at it even 2 weeks later, I was like, Jesus Christ, there is so much wrong with this thing. Starting with, number one, we had been so keen to fit so much into it that we had chosen a ridiculously small point size. So it was something like 7.2 for the features. And one of the big bits of feedback we got from people was, look, I think it's a good magazine, but I can't actually read the stories because they're too small. So kind of stuff like that. We're trying to grab it in. And it also, you know, it's a bag of ideas. So the structure is not far off what it is now, but it's much more random in terms of the sort of the stories that we were covering. It's all over the place. And the design has evolved a lot since then. But then it's been 8 years. So, you know, that's not a surprise.
You gave a TEDx presentation in Spain, I guess, for 2014. And you opened up with this line, "Everyone in this room deserves better news journalism." And you talked then about how slow journalism was the antidote for the problems afflicting media. What are you seeing in terms of the slow journalism revolution that you talked about back then? Is it taking shape?
I think it is. So there's a limited number of publications that have launched since then, specifically under this slow journalism rubric. But then I think actually, you know, for us, there's a load of stuff that is slow journalism that just doesn't happen to be kind of denominated as such. So, for example, The New Yorker, that's been going for heaven knows, you know, how long, certainly over 100 years, you know, contains lots and lots of long-form, investigative, well-reported, you know, journalism that for us would kind of completely fit into that kind of slow journalism idea, looking back on a story and really kind of getting to grips with it. I suppose a series of things have happened since then. So I think that people have started to fall out of love to a certain extent with digital news journalism and with updates. And actually, I think Brexit is a case in point. The number of people now that I speak to who say that they are just completely swearing off, you know, looking at Brexit stuff, because you could lose half of your working day just trying to stay on top of the updates. And for me, as a kind of, you know, a rabid news consumer, I just can't stop. I'm addicted. There's something happening every, you know, 5 to 10 minutes. And a lot of it is just noise and it's not super useful. So I think people are starting to fall out of love with that side of things. They're also starting to fall out of love with the digital in general and becoming aware that this smartphone in their pocket is also consuming all of their free time and reducing, you know, their quality time with the people that they love, and just dominating, as well as kind of sucking all of their information away from them. And certainly in terms of our experience with the magazine, you know, we have grown our subscriber numbers radically since 2014. Lots more people buying the magazine, lots more people kind of coming to our events and all the stuff around it. I don't know whether, you know, I don't know whether any of this kind of yet qualifies as a revolution. Probably doesn't, to be honest with you. I think that's probably just a kind of a bit of a neat kind of marketing shorthand on our part. But definitely, I think it's moving in that direction. And certainly, you know, you've got issue one. When that came out, that was a totally niche product, a very strange idea, to the extent that the Today program had us on to talk about it. And the whole piece, you know, which was fantastic for us, was couched in terms of what a weird novelty. Why would anybody pay for news stories that aren't immediately kind of current, you know, from the kind of present day? And I think that is no longer the attitude that prevails.
I've seen it I've heard people talk about it in the context of The Correspondent from Holland and now globally. And obviously Tortoise. I've seen people talking about that in depth, looking at the trends rather than the breaking news headlines. How do you feel about the likes of Tortoise? How, you know, is that a good thing for you or is that a threat?
Well, I definitely don't think it's a threat. I think that, you know, we've been kind of lucky in one sense not to have some direct kind of competitor saying that they are about slow news and slow journalism in the market. But equally also, that's a daft position for any business to be in. Of course, you need kind of people who are also in your space, drive you to kind of work harder and do better things. I haven't seen enough of Tortoise yet to know whether what they are pursuing is primarily kind of slow news stuff or more open news, because it seems to me that there's this kind of thing with them about kind of thinkings, about getting people involved in the newsroom, that speaks more to open journalism than slow journalism. I'll be interested to see when they bring out this quarterly news product, what it's like. So I don't, you know, I don't feel panicked by it. I will admit that, you know, when they were raising colossal amounts of money Kickstarter for it, I just felt a bit like, God, I wish we'd done that, or I wish we'd been kind of at the stage where we could do that. But I suppose that, you know, we've never claimed ownership of this kind of this term or this idea. So I think generally it'd probably be a positive thing for us. I think also, in a way, it's kind of a proof that we were onto something. You know, if there are significant numbers of people who want to get behind this and invest in it and so on, then that's probably quite good news for us overall.
The same could be said for your avoidance of ad funding. You know, with everyone else pivoting to reader revenues, you've never had anything else but reader revenue. You've never taken advertising.
No, and it makes me feel quite smug, you know, to feel like we were kind of prescient in that sense. Although that smugness is not justified, because, you know, a huge amount of the reason that we didn't take advertising was not some sort of like far-sighted notion that the advertising market was going to collapse and that actually reader revenue would be the most important thing. It was at the beginning that we were five editors and a designer in a room, and none of us had the capability or the chops to sell advertising. And also, we were printing such pitiful numbers for the first few issues that any advertiser would have had to be insane to, you know, pay more than 50 quid for an ad in the magazine. It's one of those things where I've been careful throughout the years not to 100% rule it out, you know, because we'll do whatever we kind of have to do in order to keep publication going. And I suppose it's one of those things where it was a practical consideration that kind of fed into the philosophy quite nicely. And I suppose also from the beginning, it was always an experimental magazine. Like, can you, in an age where everybody says it's all about giving people stuff for free online and then monetizing it through invasive adverts, can you do something that is paid for, uniquely supported by its subscribers and its readers, print only, and that is advertising free? You know, you pay for the copy and you get 120 pages of pure, beautiful, well-designed journalism. So yeah, I mean, it's quite nice, but also, like, I can't say that it was purely a philosophical crusade on my part.
In terms of your revenue now, is it as a business? I'm not thinking just about delayed gratification. I'm thinking about the Slow Journalism Company. Is your revenue mostly subscription revenue?
Yes, it is. Yeah. So it's subscription revenue. We get a decent amount from newsstand and through sales through our site. We've got a lot of events that we do. So we do regular classes. We do slow journalism nights where we kind of get people down to see our journalists and stuff like that. But subscriptions is absolutely 100% at the heart of what we do.
And have you never looked at sponsorship, even like of the events or anything like that? Or have you never had to?
We have actually, yeah. So we have a sponsor now for our events, which is fantastic. So we have our printer, Crystal Press, is backing us on our events and sponsoring us, which is enabling us to do more interesting and varied things, which is fantastic. And I totally see, yeah, I'm definitely not any sort of commercial mega brain, but I'm not a total dunce. And, you know, I can see opportunities around the site for people to participate in some editorial projects that we do in a completely sort of non-invasive way that, you know, works for both of us. So we are doing kind of things like that. But I think, you know, that one of the lovely things about the magazine is the design. You know, I think we've been very lucky with the design. We have a sensational art director, and he's been there since the beginning, so he's evolved it. But in a way, it's a kind of a lovely thing because it's a self-contained system. There's no ads in there. It's all of a piece, you know, so he kind of designs the entire thing. And, you know, we get the occasional illustrator into work, but generally it's 100% him. And that's quite rare because usually in an ad, in a magazine, sorry, what you have is you have all of these full stops along the way where there's an ad, and all of them are created obviously by completely different agencies and completely different styles. And quite often it sort of jars. So there's something, I think, that really feeds into why the magazine's so satisfying, is that it's all of a piece in terms of design.
The whole print thing also, you don't do much online, do you?
No, we don't. We put out occasional long form stories from the archive, and we put out some of our nice infographics a few months after new issues come out, and we do a weekly newsletter that pulls a couple of those together. But, you know, a very small percentage of what we do is actually online.
So at the risk of triggering your smugness again, I'm just seeing more and more stories about the resurgence of print after the death of print articles that we were sort of bombarded with for a couple of years. Now we're seeing resurgence of print. Are you seeing that? Is that something that you recognise?
Well, I always, so I suppose, you know, all of the people who set this magazine up, we were all print journalists. We all really loved it. There's something incredibly satisfying about putting something together that is finite, that has a deadline, and you work to it and you create it and then you send it off and then you get it back. Whereas actually when you're working in digital, it's just constant, it's around the clock. Nothing's ever completely done because you can always make final revisions and so on. You don't have a final product that comes out of it. It's just, you know, it's just filling up the digital space forever. So we never really thought that it had gone away. People who said that print was dead, that was nonsense. Those people have still not found a credible way to make money out of digital. But it's certainly the case that this colossal resurgence in print products, you know, that we've seen in the independent sector. So this like insane blossoming of independent titles, which is very, very exciting, is also very often not sustainable. because it's still a very difficult business model to make work. And there is the most extraordinary attrition rate in terms of independent publications. You know, there's so many that you see issue one comes out with a blast, issue two, bit kind of quiet, a bit late, and you know, it's dead by issue three or four.
So why are you still going after 33 issues? What's the secret?
We teach a class in how to launch independent magazines. And one of the things that I always say in that is there's a Woody Allen quote. I'm not sure if I'm still allowed to quote Woody Allen. I think so, probably. But he said something along the lines of 90% of success is turning up. And I think, you know, a huge amount of the reason that we're still going is because in the early years, when it was very bloody and very hand to mouth, we just kept going because we had a real bee in our bonnet. So, you know, we just like, I was working evenings and weekends doing freelance work. You know, it got really kind of tough financially for a long time. It was very difficult to get our head above the parapet and get kind of noticed. But actually, in order to get a kind of a critical mass, what you need is just to keep going. You need to keep getting those issues out there and keep juggling the money stuff. And then eventually we just sort of got into a bit of a clearing, and then it kind of started to work from there. And then, you know, so I don't think there's any magical solution. I think one thing that we profited from was that our niche appealed to journalists. So there were a lot of journalists who were sitting in those newsrooms where they'd seen half of their kind of colleagues sacked, and they were churning out stories at great speed, sometimes having to do like top and tail press releases and just bang it out there just to feed the digital beast. And actually somebody saying, do you know what? What we'd like is like 5,000 words in 3 months' time. You know, that's actually a very like appealing thing to them. So they wrote about us and we got a lot of coverage without having any kind of proper PR stance or PR, you know, people on the team. We just had a lot of stuff coming through the window. So that's been really, really good for us. Also, it's a great magazine. You know, it's beautiful, full of good stories. We pour a huge amount of attention into it, and eventually that just sort of hopefully establishes itself. Until, of course, we have a massive Brexit-induced recession, at which stage everybody cancels their subscriptions.
We end every interview, as you know, with a little question about your favourite piece of media recently. I'm hoping it's not a Brexit-related piece. But what would you recommend to our listeners?
That's a very good question. I really enjoyed recently. I tell you what, I do have something. So I have just been introduced to a podcast, which is very well known, but I hadn't experienced it before. It's called Reply All.
Oh, yeah.
And the first piece that I listened to was this brilliant piece of journalism. And the title of the episode is The Founder. And it's about this guy who was brought up in Rhodesia, moved to South Africa, was by all accounts a very friendly and lovable kid and teenager. He made a piece of software that he put out open source online, and it was for encryption. And he did it, you know, hoping that it would kind of spark people's imagination, they would improve it. But what ended up happening was a load of people just took it and commercialized it and made an insane fortune off the back of it, and he didn't get anything. And this seems to have flicked a switch in his head and turned into the dark side. And I won't sort of spoil the episode, but basically he turned into a very, very sophisticated online drug dealer and made the most extraordinary amount of money out of it. And they have this sort of forensic blow-by-blow analysis of how this happened and what the implications were. By this journalist who spent years and years and years researching it. And that, for me, that's classic piece of slow journalism. It's beautiful. It's filled with stories that you're going to tell your friends down the pub. And it has a very kind of satisfying conclusion as well. I'd highly recommend that.
So for our UK listeners, we will see you at our London live recording for our 100th episode. Join us and our shiny, shiny guests, the mighty Terry White from Empire, Karen O'Connor from The Week, Ellen Stewart from Pink News, and Mads Holman from Biblio, who are also helping us organise the whole event.
So if you want to be there, RSVPing is free but essential, so links can be found wherever we are. If you head to our social channels at Media Voices Pod or our website at voices.media.
Yeah, and you've just said for UK listeners, if you want to fly in for this, you can fly in. Brexit's not happened yet.
Why do you keep bringing it up?
So we're going on a little Easter Brexit. I mean,
Oh, no.
We're going a little Easter break. But we'll be back on May the 6th with this live episode. So tune in then.
So until our next episode on May the 6th, or May the 2nd if you come and join us in London, we'll see you there.